Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. University of Tulsa Theater presents two plays set in World War II-era North America, which documents the contrasting and complementary roles played by both men and women during the war years, a time of unprecedented national unity and purpose. The two plays are bookends of sorts. Biloxi Blues by Neil Simon is a semi-autobiographical play that's part of a very popular trilogy of comedies about his early years. And in this case, Biloxi Blues is a very funny story of Neil Simon's coming of age, both literally and figuratively, during Army basic training in a hot summer in Biloxi, Mississippi. John Morrell's Waiting for the Parade, by contrast, is set in Canada and on the home front, as wives and mothers wait anxiously for their loved ones to come home, make do with the privations of rationing, and devote their lives to furthering that united war effort. TU Theater presents these two plays in rep. Waiting for the Parade opened last night. Biloxi Blues opens tonight, and two plays will alternate through Sunday this week and then again Thursday through Sunday next week in Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. My guests today are the two directors. Michael Wright directs Biloxi Blues. Stephen Marzoff directs Waiting for the Parade, and they join us today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen and Michael, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So how did this idea get cooking to do these two World War II era plays in rep? And it's also telling two distinctly different stories.
Well, we wanted to do something that would have great commercial appeal. And when we started thinking about the possible range of things, to do a couple of shows that really touched on the whole spectrum of World War II just seemed natural. And that's how it fell together. Plus, it's really great training for our students to do something in repertory, because it's not something they often get a chance to do. And watching the shows come and go on the same stage has been, I think, a great learning lesson for them and for us as well.
And Stephen, these two plays tell two distinct stories of this particular time and place, the home front in your play and the story of what men did when they were, the issues that they were confronting as they went off to war or off to training for war, in the case of Biloxi Blues. Now, people may know Biloxi Blues because it is a really often performed Neil Simon play.
There's a film, too.
And there's a film, too, that's not too bad. But people probably don't know Waiting for the Parade. Give us a sense of what Waiting for the Parade is about.
Well, it was written in the late 70s, and it was commissioned by the Alberta Theater Project. John Morrell, who is the playwright, was commissioned to write a Canadian history play. So he wrote this play, and he took live interviews from both men and women, and he found that he was really moved by the stories that the women had. So he ended up writing this play, and it's a play about five women who are waiting for the war to end and doing what they need to do to survive. And that's kind of one of the big themes of the play, is surviving.
And it's interesting because, you know, in both Biloxi Blues, I mean, Biloxi Blues is, Waiting for the Parade is a little more bittersweet, I think, than Biloxi Blues, which is, you know, it's a broad comedy. But still, there are a lot of issues that you really don't think about when you think about the war itself. Anti-Semitism within the ranks of the military, you know, the whole idea of giving up individuality in Biloxi Blues. And in this, in Waiting for the Parade, it's all these little things of all of a sudden changing gender roles and, you know, the rationing that was a part of the war and all the sort of changes that go from the home front in the home to, you know, businesses and things like that as a part of the war effort.
Yeah, one of the things that I read, a quote that Morrell had talked about when he was interviewing the women, is that he found that they were the backbone of this war in a lot of ways, that if they would not have stepped up to the plate the way that they did, we would not have been in the, had sort of the...
sort of the buy-in to the war
effort.
That's right.
Yeah, that really, they were the backbone of that.
And it was really almost like they were participating every bit as much as the men, except they weren't actually going to war, they were depriving their household of items. They were a lot of times eliminating items in their household for scrap metal, for
exactly
everything.
Right. Yep.
And it was not like it was just scrap. It was oftentimes things they depended on.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, give us a sense of what the story's about. You have five different women, and so you have sort of these five archetype characters, right?
You do, and there's one, it's funny that you brought up the anti-Semitism. There is one woman that is a German citizen, and she moved to Canada when she was 9 years old. And just the way that she is treated, she is the outcast of the five. There are a couple of times where you see relationships starting to happen with some of the other characters, but she is really the outcast, and her story is tragic in a lot of ways, what happens to her throughout the course of the play, which was very true not only in Canada but in the United States during that time.
Yeah, and of course, we know what happened to the Japanese Americans.
Exactly,
it was not so much German, anti-German feeling during World War II, but it was certainly anti-Japanese. But it was anti-German, especially in the UK and Canada.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have a mother of soldiers as well as a wife of soldiers.
Yes. So there are five women. One of her sons is off fighting and the other is turning communist. So he is anti-war communist. And so she's dealing with that and she's kind of the worry wart of the group, an older character. And then one of the other characters, her husband, has gone to fight. And through the course of the play, you see the toll that it takes on her, because at the beginning of the play, they're in contact through letters. And then as the play goes on, months go by and she doesn't hear anything. So she starts to occupy herself with other things back home that are a little questionable. But she's doing what she can to survive.
Mm-hmm. Now, Biloxi Blues, this is a part of a trilogy of plays that Neil Simon did that sort of documenting his growing up period. And this was probably one of his most important experiences, at least from what he's written about Biloxi Blues, is saying, this is when I really grew up and became a man, literally and figuratively.
Exactly.
Figuratively. Yeah. Give us a sense of, for those who don't know Biloxi Blues, we pick up the story. Brighton Beach Memoirs tells his youth story, and now he's been drafted into the Army.
Yes, exactly. And I think of the play right now and have all along in rehearsals as a coming-of-age story. You know, so it is funny, but it's also a coming into awareness on the part of the main character, Eugene, who, you know, not only is he dealing with the fact that he's not encountered anti-Semites to the degree that he does in this particular show, but he's also dealing with sensitivity toward other people. He writes memoirs he keeps a constant journal all through the play. And in doing so, he's recording his own personal history and developing as he goes along. So we open with his reflections on what he's going into in basic training and then at the end at what he's come away from out of basic training. The essential story is we have six young men who are in Biloxi, Mississippi, in the realm of some miserable swamp that they have to march through and around. And they are under the gentle tutelage of Merwin J. Toomey, who is a sergeant to end all drill sergeants. He really is a force of nature, and he's pretty terrifying, even in the audience, let alone on stage. There are moments when I do worry about the actors a little bit, because the young man that's playing the role is really fantastic, and he's totally thrown himself into it.
Now, for people who have seen the movie, they've seen Christopher Walken's interpretation of Merwin J. Toomey. Is that the way the character's written, or how much of that is Walken?
No, that's Walken. I saw an interview with him, in fact, a couple of years ago, I think, on the Actors Studio thing, and he just talked about making the decision to underplay it on purpose, which is, you know, that's his style. He's not going to come out and rant and rave. It doesn't work for him. But this guy is written as a lunatic. And I went through basic training with some very, very nutty guys in the Air Force. And, I mean, they were in your face constantly about everything and would call, like, a little tiny string that they found on your uniform a cable, and they'd go nuts and start throwing stuff around. I mean, you know, they really do try to break you down in every possible way. And to me, that's what he's about, you know. And there are some quite serious issues in the play in terms of that kind of stuff. How do you stand up to somebody who is effectively a licensed bully?
Yeah, indeed. And I would think for your young actor who's portraying Merwin J. Toomey, getting away from that Christopher Walken thing would be very difficult, because it was such a signature role for him, and it was, you know, was all over television for a generation or more.
I begged them not to see the movie, and honestly, I don't know if he's seen the movie or not. We've never discussed it. We built his character from the ground up, and we did a lot of stuff to make it personally his. Toomey refers to having been wounded in North Africa, and so we did an improv in which he and the men were all under fire, and that there was a mortar shell that landed, and we kind of reenacted his wound and went to the hospital and cared for him and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it really helped them to dig in very fully so that they're bringing their lives to the characters' lives and mixing those well.
And I think that's one of your big tasks for both of you as directors, is the idea that this is so long ago for your actors. I mean, even Saving Private Ryan is before most of these kids' time. How do you give them a sense of what this total war literally was like?
Well, one of the things that I was talking to them about is there is a scene towards the end of the play where, you know, the war is finally over with, And this sense of, and what I've been telling the ladies is that for 6 years this has been going on. The stakes are so huge for you to find out finally war is over, Eisenhower signed it. I mean, is just like you have been constricted for 6 years, and it is just instant freedom. And we did some improvs at the beginning, kind of similar to Michael, where I would put them in situations where they were at a sort of a meeting, and then war was declared on Canada. I just arbitrarily threw that out, and what the effect was there. And then they were having another meeting, and all of a sudden, you know, they have signed the peace treaty, war is over with. And in the improvs, I think, really helped them a lot to kind of find the depth, because that is something we are just not quite used to.
Well, actually, we are used to it. Most of your actors, since they have been in grade school, we've been at war.
Yep.
But it has been a very different war.
Yeah, it is very different.
And it's a war that, unless you're in a military family, has really not affected you that much. And I think it gives you a false sense of what that era in the 1940s was like, because it was completely different.
Right. Well, my cast has been saturated with the music, tons and tons of images that the designers came up with for their design project. And we've been very lucky. I'm on the board at Circle, and so I have a good relationship with the chair of the board, Clark Weens, and he was able to connect me to a woman named Nancy Hauger, who works with World War II vets. And so we have brought, on two different occasions, four altogether World War II vets to come in and tell their stories and to share the things that they went through. And it's been very, very helpful. You know, one of the students said to the guy, asked, what was it like on the troop ship? And he said, stinky. You know, and you immediately get a sense of, yeah, that's right. Of course, what else would it be? You know, it's not going to be a luxury liner, you know. So, you know, and they talked about storming the beaches. A couple of them were D-Day plus one, and, you know, just the things that they went through. And one of them was quite remarkable. He said, you know, we weren't necessarily just the sweetie pie soldiers. We went over there and we did what we had to do. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't, the Germans would have won. So we had to fight exactly as they were. And that was quite a revelation for my cast.
Mm. My guests today are Michael Wright, who's directing Biloxi Blues. Stephen Marzoff is directing Waiting for the Parade, telling two distinct stories of World War II as TU Theater presents these two plays in repertory. Now, let's talk about putting these two plays in rep. I mean, that's something university theaters don't do all that often.
Not really, no.
What's the planning like, man, on doing this? So obviously, you have to sort of have come to some sort of common compromise on set design. I mean, are you using a common set? Or,
yeah.
I mean, you have a barracks in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I assume it's like where's the main setting for Waiting for the Parade?
Well, each woman has a space. They have kind of their home space where they're lit through the play waiting. And then there's a common area where if there are scenes with more than two people, they come down into that common area.
Yeah. So how did you work out the design elements to make sure that you can go from play to play in a given night?
Well, we were very lucky. Stephen and I met separately with Susan Barrett's design class and challenged them to come up with something that would work for both. And a young gentleman named Shiloh Thaxton, who is in my show as one of the soldiers, came up with a design that works quite well. And actually, for my show, I never thought about it till at some point last night during rehearsal. I thought, oh, this kind of looks like a train, you know, because we started in the train, and then we moved to the barracks, and the sergeant's office is next door to that. The latrine is right next to the barracks, and then a multi-purpose area that functions as two distinctly different scene components is at the very end. And so the whole play almost kind of lines out like a long train. It works very well. It means that we've got to break down one set and put in the other. So it's been a little bit of I think of it as sort of D-Day theater in a lot of ways. Because, you know, it's a lot of work to get those things in and out, especially my stuff, because we have these very, very heavy bunks that the guys have to occupy in the barracks. But I think it's worked really beautifully. And in some ways, it's been helpful to Susan, who's doing the lighting design, in that she can incorporate similar lighting elements from show to show, but then she makes distinctive choices for each show that give them the right quality.
Now, the rehearsal period, usually when you're preparing a play, it's like every night. Obviously, you can't have the theater every night. You have to have it every other night. How have you been working out rehearsal schedules?
Well, I think one of the big things is that Michael and I, from the beginning, have collaborated really well together on sharing space. So we would go on a weekly basis. One week Michael would be in the theater, and that week we would be in the rehearsal hall, and then the next week we'd flip-flop. We'd get to be in the theater for a week. Michael's cast would be in the rehearsal hall. And so the communication between he and I has been, I think, really good and collaborative in sharing space throughout this process.
Now, it's interesting. Your plays basically are, one is a male-dominated play, the other is a female-dominated play. That obviously is very important. What about giving the students the experience in doing rep? I mean, I assume this is something they do in the summer, maybe, when they're doing acting internships and things like that?
One would hope, yeah, that they're getting out and doing some of those summer stock theaters where it's really insane. You're turning a show around in a week.
Yeah.
You know, so this has been more of a luxury in a lot of ways than we might normally have had.
But can you maybe talk about the experience of doing rep performances? That's one of those things you have to learn to do if you're really going to be an actor.
Oh, and it's fun, too, because I'm a professional actor as well, uh-huh. And it's delicious to be able to. The big difference between what we're doing and what you would do in the professional world is that you would be doing both shows. So
yeah.
You would have an actor in Waiting for the Parade also acting in Biloxi Blues, and so you'd flip-flop on a nightly basis, which is awesome as an actor to be able to do that. So this is a little different, but the big thing for me in this that I think is that opening their eyes to is the sense of community and collaboration between the two casts, which is essential in theater. If you don't have that, you're done, as far as I'm concerned. So that has been, I think, the big thing that their eyes have been opened to with this process.
Mm-hmm. We wanted to have a USO dance. We didn't get around to it, but on the day of the celebration of Dr. King's birthday, we decided to have a potluck dinner. Mm-hmm. We knew we had to rehearse. We couldn't give them the night off because it's just too close to putting the shows all the way up. So we had a big potluck, and everybody came and enjoyed and intermingled, and it was wonderful.
What do you think your kids have learned about this era? Because, I mean, again, this is a foreign time to them. They're in it. They've grown up with the specter of war around, but it's a very different sort of war than what America experienced in World War II, or Canada, for that matter. What do you think your kids have really learned about this particular time period? Because I know that in a college production, you're doing lots of research because your kids don't have that long well of experience, so they have to do research to make up the difference.
I think the main thing I can speak for my cast is that they're beginning to recognize that people exactly like themselves were the ones who went and fought the war, you know, so the experience of that. You know, crazy things that might not seem to play into it, like just clomping around in combat boots and getting used to that, having to learn how to walk with that. And for the women who play, on the one hand, all three of the women played the two female roles. We just sort of rotating them through the show.
In Biloxi Blues.
In Biloxi Blues. And one of them is a prostitute, and one of them is a sweet young girl from the nearby Catholic school girls. I can't say it right. Anyway, you know what I'm trying to say. And going back and forth between those and the clothing for those and all the things that go along with it, you know, and things that we've narrowed down a little bit, like smoking, for example. There's a little bit of smoking. If we were really doing this, everybody would be smoking. I don't think I have a single student who smokes in my show. So, you know, they're just kind of learning about all kinds of interdependent things and dependent things and so forth.
And what about your cast, Stephen?
The big thing is the difference between then and today, one of them is social media. So one of the themes for Waiting for the Parade is this sense of waiting and not knowing. Social media today, you know instantly what's going on. Back then, you didn't. So if you didn't get a letter for a week, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, you had no idea what was going on.
And part of you had to assume everything was okay and that the person wasn't able to write or in a situation where the mail couldn't get delivered. And that's just a pretty foreign idea to today's kids.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. My guest today, Michael Wright, Stephen Marzoff, the directors of Biloxi Blues and Waiting for the Parade, two plays set during World War II. Biloxi Blues, a famous play by Neil Simon. John Morrell's Waiting for the Parade is actually a Canadian playwright or American playwright who lived in Canada and done in the 1970s. They're written about the same time, aren't they?
Yes.
And they'll be in rep tonight through Sunday and then again Thursday through Sunday next week. They're our guest today on Studio Tulsa.
Certainly one of the things that my guys are looking at is the reality of not having a lot of personal choice. You know, the characters in the show were all drafted. And so they were thrown into this environment together and they had to figure out how to cope, you know. For, you know, these young people today, you know, they elect to come to the university and they elect to live where they want to live in the university. I mean, they have an awful lot of choice available to them, where these guys did not. And I think certainly from talking to the World War II vets, they got a much better idea of how that world really closes in on you fast. You know, they were talking about, you know, somebody said, well, what's it like to be in a battle? which, you know, on the one hand seems like kind of a goofy question, because what do you think it might be like? But the guy said, it's absolute, endless, total confusion and chaos. You know, and from the movies that we've all watched, it seems a little bit more structured.
So they don't have a director in war.
Exactly, precisely, exactly. So I think, you know, what they've learned is that, you know, there's the incredible compressing structure of the barracks and the basic training, and then there's the reality of what actually happens. I mean, some of the summaries that Eugene gives at the end of the show about what happened to the other characters is quite moving, and it's, you know, it's a very beautiful play for that reason, because it's not strictly a comedy. It's really a comedy drama. I'm not sure what those categories should be called, but I think it works on a lot of levels because of that.
Well, that's the thing we always have to remember, you know, it's after this war, I think Eugene makes this statement. It says, you know, I was never alive as I was in that summer in Biloxi.
Right.
And yet they all went off and did, you know, they just went on with their lives afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, for your female characters in Waiting for the Parade, I think you get in a lot of different issues of, you know, the war was one of these times where it broke down issues of class, similar to men. But for the women, it was like all of a sudden you're breaking sort of gender roles, as well as, you know, I mean, there were women who were working prior to the war, but all of a sudden in the war, everybody worked or had a job, and that was a big class divide that was shattered.
That's exactly right. And one of the characters in the show, she doesn't have a job. Her husband actually stayed, and he is a radio broadcaster and broadcasting the news and updates and all of that stuff. So what she does is she decides to go the route of working for, like, the Red Cross and gathering people together to get supplies for the men as the trains would go through. They would stop at each of the train stations, and she was that was kind of what
she ran the canteen.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So everybody was doing something, whether they were working, say, a job that one of the men would work, or if they were doing some sort of charity work or something like that.
Give us a sense of the arc of these female characters through the course of the play. I mean, obviously they're adapting to a new reality, but what changes as time goes on during this play?
For some of the characters, there's a sense of liberation. The character of Eve is the final character that I haven't talked about, and her husband actually is older. Eve is like mid to late 20s. Her husband is mid to late 50s. And so he was not able to go and fight, and he's very bitter and upset about that. And a very oppressing towards her. So through the course of this play, we see her at the beginning, and she's very kind of meek, very emotional, almost wounded. And by the end of the play, she turns a gun on him. So, I mean, she really comes of age and becomes liberated throughout this play. And I think that in some way, all of the women go through that journey. Some of them, by the end of it, it's a little harder what they have to deal with. And some of them, like Eve, there is a sense of real liberation and freedom that they find.
Now, the name of the play is Waiting for the Parade. Does the parade ever come, or do we find that, maybe there's not a parade, just as we're finding right now in contemporary society as men leave Iraq and leaving Afghanistan?
Can I leave that as the cliffhanger for people to come and see the show?
I think that's a good thing, yeah. All right, well... Biloxi Blues opens tonight, and then Waiting for the Parade continues on Saturday, and then next week it will be Biloxi Blues on Thursday and Saturday,
right?
And then Waiting for the Parade Friday and Sunday, and there are Sunday matinees both weekends at Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. Gentlemen, have a great run. Waiting for the Parade, Biloxi Blues, running in rep at TU Theater. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Directors Michael Wright and Stephen Marzoff talking about their two plays, which are being performed in rep by University of Tulsa Theater. The two plays set during World War II are Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues, which opens tonight. John Morrell's Waiting for the Parade continues on Saturday night. And the two plays will alternate through Sunday this weekend and Thursday through Sunday next week in Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. For ticket information, call the TU box office at 918-631-2567. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
This is a story about clarity and irony. The title is, Why There's Your Problem Right There. The story begins with the stars. For years, I've made a wish on the first star I see, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. It's a poetic way to button the day to the night, and it's a private little ritual for tossing wishes into the sky. But one persistent wish is that more wishes would come true. And then, just last week, I discovered that what I've been wishing on a lot of times is not the first star, but the bright International Space Station. That's the clarity part of the story. Why, there's my problem right there. I've been wishing on a space station. The irony is that I am in constant flight from modern gadgets, iPods, apps, smartphones, even a cell phone. I hear the words and run the other way with my old-fashioned paper and pencil. The farther I flee from gadgets that keep me wired to other people all the time, the closer I want to be to the natural Earth. I'm reading The Sea Around Us by Rachel Carson and learning about rivers that flow deep in the ocean. And I'm reading The Natural Navigator by Tristan Gooley and what all I can learn from a spider's web or a crescent moon. I'm making an effort to unplug and look around me, starting with those ancient navigational guides, the stars and the moon. It's a humbling experience to realize that I can no longer pick out the constellations, but the African dung beetle works at night using the Milky Way as its compass. Birds, seals, and butterflies also depend on the stars to find their way. The steady waxing and waning of the moon is so lovely, no wonder Native American tribes identified the seasons by the full moons. The Cherokees call them the cold moon of January, the bony moon of February, the green corn moon of June, the harvest moon of October. Now, I'm as obsessed with time as other people. Wasting time, not enough time, time going too fast, time heals, timing is everything, time is on my side. And just when I think I've roped and saddled time, the universe puts me in my place. I may parse my day with meetings and schedules and clocks that tick and talk and chop the hour into seconds, but what is really happening is that my organs and tissues and cells move to a gray rhythm of day and night. I read that our biological rhythms are so intricate, each one of us carries 2 trillion clocks inside us. Some are set by the way our brains and eyes react to the sun. Our chemistry is tied to the spinning of the Earth and Moon, but scientists now tell us that our cells beat to an even bigger drum, the universe itself. The minerals and soil samples from the Moon are similar to the Earth's crusts, which links us to the Big Bang Theory of 4 billion years ago. Not only our seasons, but our internal clocks. And this is the part I like best. Our bodies are composed of elements from the supernova explosion and the birth of the stars. So we are connected genetically to the solar system. That's what Carl Sagan meant when he said, "We are stardust." We are so mighty, and we are so small. Here's a quote I like. "Any star can be devoured by human adoration, sparkle by sparkle." And who said that? Shirley Temple.
Connie Cronley is a freelance writer and the executive director of Iron Gate, a soup kitchen and food pantry in downtown Tulsa. She's a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs or just want to look through our archives, they're available anytime online at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Have a great weekend.